Well, take your Bible, if you will, and turn again to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. I should say for the first time to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. If you've been with us for our verse-by-verse study of Ecclesiastes, you know that Solomon is presenting to us the most intense, thorough study of the ramifications of worshiping all the wrong things. In a season of ongoing unrepentant sin, Solomon dedicated his life to turning into idols all of the good gifts God has given man to enjoy in this life. And his conclusion is that chasing the wrong things in life always leads to nothing more than emptiness. Now remember, this is a man with unparalleled resources. He has unparalleled power as a king. He has a divine element of wisdom enabling him to evaluate everything he tests from an honest, accurate, biblical perspective. And so there is no one in the history of mankind more equipped to perform these tests and give us God's perspective on digging cisterns that by default are broken and useless. Now, because Solomon is one of the wisest men to have ever lived, he knows that people learn best from repetition. And so his method of instruction is to state the idol he pursued, then the result of that empty pursuit, and then he doubles back repeatedly to ensure that we don't miss the lessons that he's teaching. Now, having said that, here's where we are in the text. So far, Solomon has given us the final conclusion of seeking fulfillment and lasting satisfaction in anyone or anything other than God. His conclusion? Everything is meaningless without God at the center of life. Solomon then began to give us the results of digging wells that in several areas of life. He began by telling us the result of every pursuit of fulfillment under the sun approach. It resulted in emptiness, total emptiness. Nothing he pursued apart from God resulted in lasting satisfaction. He first began by pursuing worldly wisdom for lasting fulfillment, wisdom itself, then the differing approaches to man pursuing wisdom, and the result was emptiness, like trying to capture the wind. We described it as a soap bubble, pretty for a moment, glistening in the sun, and then it bursts and is gone. Then he contrasted wisdom with immorality. The result, emptiness. In other words, using the wisdom of the world, thinking like a pagan would think, Solomon tried to gain as much understanding and knowledge as he could about the world that God gave him to live in. He pursued education and wisdom and knowledge as no one before him had done. And the fuller his mastery of these fields, the emptier they seemed. He then described the pursuit of pleasure. He pursued lasting fulfillment in comedy, humor. The result? Emptiness. Oh, momentary joy, then emptiness. Fine wine, while sober, result? Emptiness. He built beautiful, massive buildings. The result? Emptiness. Planted vineyards, leading to emptiness. Built gardens and parks. Planted all kinds of fruit trees like in the Garden of Eden. The result? Emptiness. He developed sophisticated irrigation systems to irrigate it all. Marvels of engineering. The result? Emptiness. He purchased male and female slaves who produced more homeborn slaves. Result? Emptiness. He possessed flocks and herds larger than all who preceded him in Jerusalem. The result? Emptiness. He collected silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. The result? Emptiness. He provided for himself male and female singers. The result? Emptiness. He provided for himself many concubines for sexual pleasure. The result? Emptiness. He pursued and purchased everything in life he wanted. Nothing stopped him, and he chased it all because he believed he deserved it all. The result was emptiness. His conclusion, the conclusion of the wisest man who ever lived, chapter 2, verse 11. Thus I considered my activities, all of them, which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted, and check this out, he says, behold, all was vanity. That's that word for soap bubble. Uselessness. And striving after wind, and there was no profit under the sun. It was all nothing more than a soap bubble that soon was burst. It was like trying to shepherd, literally the text says, or capture the wind. And it all resulted in emptiness, because in an under the sun approach, it always results in emptiness. That under the sun approach is the approach Solomon takes for much of this book to explain the pursuits man undergoes apart from God. He then talked about the empty pursuit of labor, and he concluded chapter 2 by encouraging us to enjoy the good gifts God has given us to enjoy. In verses 24 and 26, he concludes that true enjoyment in this life depends on a higher source than man. Look at verse 24. There is nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I have seen, that it is from the hand of God. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? Very interesting verse. The world pursues enjoyment apart from God. And the world believes that they are experiencing enjoyment when in fact, it's a facade. It's a soap bubble. That's why the world trades out its idols for new idols. For who can eat and who can have enjoyment without Him? Answer, no one. For to a person who is good in His sight, He has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, that's a God follower, while to the sinner He has given the task of gathering and collecting so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This too is vanity and striving after the wind. In the end, the good guy wins. Because in the end, the good guy belongs to God. Now that brings us to chapter 3. And the overarching theme of this section continues on from the end of chapter 2, and it now has to do with the sovereignty of God. Follow along as I read our passage to you. There is an appointed time for everything. There is a time for every event under heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart and a time to sew together. A time to be silent and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate in its time. He has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There is nothing to add to it, and there is nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. That which he has done already, that which has been already, and that which will be has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. Now, don't forget, and I've already mentioned this, don't forget, as we work our way through Solomon's Ecclesiastes here, that there are two main perspectives that he describes. You have to keep that in perspective to understand this book. The under-the-sun perspective is a view of life apart from God. The unredeemed man lives life under the sun. His mentality doesn't go above the sun. He's not thinking of God, the eternality of God. It's the sun beating down on him. That's as far as he gets. Conversely, implied is that an above-the-sun perspective understands that when God is at the center of life, life can be and should be enjoyed as a gift from him. And so, having just talked about the fact that true enjoyment in this life depends on a higher source than man, Solomon turns to talk about the reality of time that sets the boundaries on everything that man does in this lifetime. Now, if Solomon wanted to speak about the curse of time, he could have talked about how short time is, that we do not ever have the time to do what we want or need to do. There's never enough time. Or he could have talked about the fact that time controls us. We are at the mercy of the clock. We can't control time. It controls us. One ancient philosopher wrote of the tyranny of the timepiece. Commentator Ryken, quoting the philosopher Plautus, wrote that the gods confound the man who first found out how to distinguish hours. Confound him who has cut and hacked my days so wretchedly into small pieces. Confound him who in this place set up a sundial. It's an interesting approach. Solomon also could have talked about the fact that time is always fleeting, that we're running out of time, and that once it's gone, it can never, ever be recaptured. It's gone. American educator Horace Mann once wrote the following want ad: lost yesterday, somewhere between sunrise and sunset, two golden hours. Each set with 60 diamond minutes, no reward is offered, for they are gone forever. These are all things that Solomon could have said concerning time, because those certainly are the thoughts of the man with an under-the-sun perspective. Instead, he wrote a poem, in essence really a list in poetic form, about the perfect orderliness of every time that God has ordained for all that he has created. Now, you should know that this is the world's most famous poem on the subject of time. This poem is so famous that even people who don't know the Bible and don't know this comes from the Bible have heard it. Some can recite it. The folk singer Pete Seeger set it to music in the 50s with a tune that the Byrds popularized in their 60s hit called Turn, Turn, Turn. Most of our church will recognize that. Some of you will have to Google that. Now look at the text here, verse 1. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. Now what that is a summary statement about the poem, the list that he's about to give us. He will then go on to describe exactly what he's talking about. Now, there are two details that you have to understand to get what Solomon is saying here. Number one, he has just said in verses 24, 25, and 26 that any true enjoyment in this life depends on a higher source than man, namely God. Here, he continues to say that the constraints of time can only be appreciated when one understands the sovereignty of God over the details of life. When he uses the phrase, see it in verse 1, under heaven, when he uses the phrase under heaven, he is not talking about the pursuit of lasting fulfillment apart from God. He uses that phrase three times in Ecclesiastes. He's simply talking about the reality of everyday life on earth. The phrase speaks of everything that happens in this time-bound universe that is under the sovereign authority of the God who rules from heaven. This is key here because if you do not understand that God is sovereign over all of the details of life, you are going to conclude that man is simply the product or better, the victim of an uncaring, unloving God. And so the theme of this beloved poem on time is really all about understanding and appreciating the sovereignty of God over time and eternity. Life, because of the fall, includes both the good and the bad, the positive and the negative experiences in this life. And so as we look at this little poem, in reality, a list, it's inspired by God. There's much we can learn about God here and then our stewardship of the time God has given us to be used for His honor and His glory. So get this. Just as true enjoyment in life cannot be gained without God at the center of one's life, so time cannot be rightly appreciated without a proper understanding of God's sovereignty over all that He created. Now notice that Solomon does not mention God in these first 8 verses. Did you catch that? Really 9 verses. Solomon does mention Him in the verses that follow. God is sovereign over time and whatever happens in time. That's the point of the summary in verse 1. In other words, Solomon says, nothing happens outside the will of God. That's what he's saying. Now look at the structure of the poem here. Ryken and other commentators explain the structure for us. Notice that Solomon's poem is a parallel series of related opposites. Each pair forms what's called a merism, M-E-R-I-S-M, a merism. It's a figure of speech in which two polarities make up a whole. For example, when the Bible says that God created the heavens and the earth, Genesis 1:1, what it means there is that God created the entire universe. That's what that means. In the same way, each of the pairs in Ecclesiastes 3 make up a larger whole. Together, birth and death comprise the whole of human existence. Weeping and laughing summarize the full range of human emotion, and so on. There's something comprehensive then about each pair that he mentions. Solomon presents 14 couplets and 28 statements. There are 14 negative statements and 14 positive statements. His main focus? Time. Time. It occurs 29 times in these verses. There is also something comprehensive about the list as a whole. The pairs themselves seem to take in the whole sweep of human experience, from birth to death, from war to peace. That's where the poem ends, and everything in between. Words in the words of commentator H.C. Leupold, the pairs in Solomon's poem cover the widest possible range and thus practically every aspect of human life. I don't think that's a mistake. Now look at it this way. God is the king of all things. Guess what that includes? Time. He regulates every minute and every second in life. He rules all of our moments and all of our days. In other words, nothing happens in life without his superintendence. Does he cause those things to happen? No, or you couldn't be responsible for them. Does he ordain that it happens? Yes. Does anything that happened ever surprise him? No. Everything happens when it happens because God is sovereign over time as well as eternity. And I think perhaps the easiest way for you to understand this is to remember that God is never, ever surprised. Oh, I didn't think he'd do that. Look at that. He confers with the Son and the Spirit. Did you see that? I didn't think he'd do that. No, that doesn't ever happen. Solomon is also saying here that there is a definite order. That's a key principle here. There is a definite order to the way God does things. He is a precise God, absolute in his authority over space and time. He puts everything in its own time and it's in its own place. His sovereignty has a chronology, and that has been the case from the very beginning of time when God divided the days of creation. We see it, for example, in every change of season. The turning of summer into autumn. The coming of springtime after winter. The rhythms of creation testify to the orderliness of their Creator. God said it this way in Genesis 8:22 after the worldwide flood, "While the earth remains, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter and day and night shall not cease." And so here in Ecclesiastes 3, Solomon wants us to rejoice in God's sovereign order as it applies to the activities and the relationships of life. That's why Solomon begins with, "There is an appointed time for everything." That means everything. And there is a time for every event under heaven. None of it surprises God. And it all happens exactly on time. It's foreordained, it's not forecaused. God can't be surprised. Now, it's not that man is locked into God's hamster wheel of time. That's not the point here. Rather, that God does everything at just the right time. Everything happens according to his sovereign plan. The key idea here is orderliness. God is a God of order. That's what the evolutionists cannot get around. Creation is orderly. take a microscope and look at it, and it's clear someone, somewhere, put together stuff that works perfectly so that your eyeball can see things. Conclusion, there has to be a higher power someplace that did things in an orderly fashion. Now, let me give you his purpose here. Commentator Goldberg points this out. The conclusion comes in verses 9 through 15. While he says that all human activities have their proper time, he goes beyond a superficial observation. Actually, he says Solomon has two conclusions here. Number one, if the times and seasons are in the hands of God, then there is a sovereign action of God that transcends anything man can do. Man can't do something outside of God's timetable. Look at verse 9. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? Well, it's all in place. It's all ordained. Is there something man can do to change these things? And then secondly, everything that will happen, even the calamities in life, are a part of God's plan. Look at verse 11. He, that's God, has made everything appropriate. And the word there literally is beautiful. Think that through. He has made everything appropriate or beautiful in its time. And see, if man can see and accept the sovereignty of God, then the true God follower will trust God wholeheartedly. If you doubt that he's in control, you've got a problem. You're going to end up in the wrong place. This highlights the difference between the one who is the under-the-sun mentality, the one with the under-the-sun perspective, versus the one with the above-the-sun mentality. The God follower, when considering time, as Solomon describes it, can only conclude with peace of mind that man is not the master of his own fate when it comes to the details of life. Now look at Solomon's list here. Look at Solomon's list here. And the Hebrew grammar here tells us, it's fascinating to study. I didn't want to put you to sleep with it, but it's fascinating to look at the chiasms here and how things are interposed and put in between, and it all aims at a certain process whose purpose is to help people memorize the poem. It's written in a way so that people can easily memorize the poem. Verse 2. A time to give birth and a time to die. Now, right here, you can stop right here, think about this for a moment, and you know that both birth and death are solely in the hands of a sovereign God. You plan all you want, only God can make a baby. You plan all you want for it to be delivered at a certain time, only God can make a baby. And only God can superintend those details. You may plan a time for conception, but only God can make a baby. Conversely, the precise moment of your death was determined by God in eternity past, long before anything else was ever created. The writer of Hebrews says that we are destined for the precise moment we will die, and we can neither hasten it nor prolong it. Hebrews 9:27. Catch this. Even should one commit suicide, he dies the precise moment God determined he would die in eternity past. You'll hear people say things like, well, he died before his time. Well, if he did, he surprised God. The point is obvious. We have no control over these events. They are fixed times. These are simply the facts of life in a world under the sovereign control of God. Verse 2. A time to plant and a time to uproot that which is planted. If you know anything about gardening, you understand this. There are times when plants and vines and trees are planted because there is an ordained order of the planting season. Wheat is not planted in the dead of winter. There are specified times when fruit trees are planted. The farmer cannot go against an ordained time when planting must take place and produce a successful crop. It just doesn't work that way. And you'll remember that Solomon had planted the greatest and most beautiful parks containing fruit trees and all kinds of growing things in his vineyards and gardens and orchards to be compared with the Garden of Eden. So he knows what he's talking about. In the same way, there are times when the fruit trees must be uprooted because they no longer bear fruit. There are times when vineyards have to be rooted up because they've fallen prey to disease. Bottom line, God causes the growth and establishes the seasons when those things take place. The growth in nature is not exempt from non-productivity and death any more than human beings are. There is a time when plants and trees die. Verse 3, a time to kill and a time to heal. Now, understand, Solomon is not suggesting for a moment that people go around killing one another. What he is saying is that in a world filled with unregenerate men, there will be individuals and nations who will suffer the judgment of God when he decrees their death and destruction. God has and will continue to use war to exercise his providential rule among the nations to curb evil. And the same is true for believers when they persist in their wrongdoing. It appears as if God takes them home before their time so that God's work would not be impacted negatively. But that's not the case. Verse 3, there's a time to tear down and a time to build up. God does give healing as well. And after great conflicts, there comes the time of peace and a time to forget the horrors of war and death. Man rebuilds what was torn down, even as it happened after World War II. This is true also for God's people when they have been disciplined. Hosea 6:1, listen to this. He has torn us to pieces, but he will heal us. He has injured us, but he will bind up our wounds. That's what Solomon's talking about. After a time of tearing down, there is typically a time of building up. Precious are those times when the sinner returns and repents and confesses and repents and is restored. Or, as in Judges 2:18, when a nation turns back to God. After the 70 years were accomplished for Judah in exile, the promise of Jeremiah, the prophet, was fulfilled when God's people were permitted to return and build again the temple and the walls around the city. Jeremiah 24:6-7. That word to build up, it can also have a spiritual connotation because Jeremiah prophesied that besides the restoration of the land of Judah, God promised the exiles who returned that they would get a new heart to know him. Verse 4, a time to weep and a time to laugh. There are those times when we weep and when we mourn as a result of the events in verses 2 and 3. Sorrow and grief are a natural part of living life in a fallen world. And none of it comes as a surprise to God. It's normal and it's natural. It's often these times when men learn to lean more heavily on God and the unrepentant turn to God for relief. In other words, in God's perspective, they are not necessarily useless times. We think they're useless. Why? Because we can't see the big picture. Even in times of grief, we can know that that time of grief will lessen. It may not entirely disappear, but it will lessen. Verse 4, a time to mourn and a time to dance. By the way, the reference to dancing is either to group dancing, which would be similar to our square dancing in the United States. It's how groups would dance in Israel. Or to the kind of dancing in which David was engaged when the ark was brought into the area where the first temple was to stand. That occasion was a time to laugh and rejoice because of God's goodness. Verse 5, a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. You say, what does that mean? Well, as I told you, verses 2 through 8 follow the pattern of Hebrew poetry. And each verse exhibits synonymous parallelism. And so when you find a phrase that doesn't make sense, you look at the next phrase, and that typically sheds light on it. That means that the second line of a verse can shed light on what is meant in the first line. So look at verse 5. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. Here's the second line. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. Simply stated, without too many details, there is a time to embrace a wife. There is a time to abstain from embracing a wife. So, there is a time to gather up precious stones for building purposes and to discard useless stones. In other words, the same objects or persons can be treated differently on various occasions. Verse 6, a time to search and a time to give up as lost, a time to keep and a time to throw away. There are times when we search for lost possessions and we keep what's appropriate. On the other hand, when we cannot find what was lost, we give up the search because the time extended is not worth the value of the thing that we lost. Some might take this, put it on a plaque, and hang it in your garage. There's a time to keep and a time to throw away, and probably the time you think you should be keeping is really the time you should be throwing away. Verse 7, a time to tear apart and a time to sew together. Tearing typically refers to a common custom in Israel where they would tear their clothes as they grieved over the death of a loved one. Continued through the centuries, and by the way, you can still see that today in many different cultures around the world. Conversely, sewing together describes the sewing of the tear after the period of mourning is over. The parallelism is continued in the second line. In the period of mourning, silence is observed. A time to be silent, a time to speak. In the time of mourning, that's not the time to speak. People will often say, well, what can I say to that person who's suffering the loss of a loved one? What can I say? What words can I possibly find? And the answer is none. None. You learn as a young pastor, the foolish thing to do is to open your mouth and preach a sermon. The wise thing to do is to keep your mouth shut. Sit there in silence with them. Weep with those who weep. Laugh with those who laugh. A time to be silent, a time to speak. People in mourning resumed their normal speech only after a period of mourning was over. And then notice that Solomon mentions love and hate, two of the strongest emotions known to man. Verse 8, a time to love and a time to hate. Made in the image of God, a person does have the capacity to love to a certain degree, but not perfectly as God does. We're to love because God first loved us. We are to hate what God hates, nothing more and nothing less. And to do so, catch this, with without sin. God hates. He does it without sin. Jesus hated, and he did it without sin. That speaks of the personal level. Notice he concludes considering the national level, verse 8. A time for war and a time for peace. There are certain attacks on a country that the country must respond to, and a time when certain slights can be ignored. To get that wrong sets a nation up to be a hated target for everyone. And you can probably think of a couple of countries that right now are getting this principle backwards. Now, right here, Solomon asks the question that the one with the under the sun perspective is going to ask. We know that because he asks it repeatedly through this book. Look at verse 9. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? That's the same question he asked way back in chapter 1, verse 3. What advantage does man have in all of his work? What did I do this for? Which he does, look at it, under the sun. Now that seems like a fair question. If God controls the moments of life, then what is the point of my work? Why should I even bother to punch in on time when tomorrow morning rolls around? Well, Solomon's intent here, as he has just demonstrated in verses 2 through 8, is not the least bit negative. Rather, when man understands God's role in life, he graciously recognizes and understands the various times God has ordained and the proper priority of the man with the above-the-sun perspective. So he says in verse 10, I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. Now, as we've already seen, Solomon has thoroughly researched many of the empty pursuits the man with the under-the-sun perspective chases, only to wind up with broken cisterns. They don't hold any water. The Hebrew word for task is the same as in 1:13, where it's rendered heavy burden, and 2:26, where it has the idea of a task or a form of business. Here, it's merely the continual burden which with men are engaged during a lifetime. But rather than becoming saddened or depressed, the teacher immediately moves on to another consideration in verse 11. The times ordained by God in which men work are not to be seen as something settled in concrete. In other words, we are to see an unfolding pattern where life refuses to stay still for even one moment. And the reason for that is because God is ordaining all the elements of life, not causing them, ordaining that it would take place. God has made everything beautiful. Verse 11, He, God, has made everything appropriate in its time. Well, I don't think so. This is not an appropriate use of time. I think perhaps my marriage could fall apart. I think perhaps my child could die, spend eternity in hell. What is this? God has made everything appropriate in its time. In other words, God is in control, and his control is perfect. Therefore, the events of verses 2 through 8 are to be seen as a part of the whole plan of God. This is how life is in a fallen world. Taken in isolated pieces, each of the times appears to be ugly with no meaning. But when it's seen as God sees it, there's a beautiful pattern to the plan. In other words, you've all seen this, what we see are the knots and the loose ends of the thread on the backside of the needlepoint. But on the front side, God is knitting a perfect masterpiece. In other words, the sovereign plan of God is right on track in every single man's life. I don't know how many times someone who has gone through just a horrific season in life later has said to me, "You know what? Every minute of it was as close to hell as I'll ever get, but I'm grateful that God carried me through that time because I now can see and understand and experience and empathize with others who have gone through similar circumstances." Well, you're not going to see that when you're looking at the knots and the loose ends on the back of the needlepoint. Your tendency is to take an under-the-sun approach and curse God. Is that not what Job's wife encouraged him to do? "Your life's a mess, buddy. Curse God, die, and be done with this." "Thank you, sweetheart." In other words, the sovereign plan of God is right on track in every single person's life. So then, notice that in his wisdom, Solomon now mentions the much bigger picture that the one with the biblical perspective always has in mind. Verse 11, "He," who's that? God, "has also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end." And what he's saying is that when you stop focusing on the moment-by-moment struggles in the painful season of life and focus on eternity, your perspective changes. You go from "this is my life" to "this is a season of my life." And like Job, I don't get it. I don't know why I need to go through this, but God does. And so I'll joyfully submit to God's plan in my life, even though I can't begin to understand it. You begin to understand that every single moment of life, from eternity past through the present on into eternity, has been ordained by a sovereign God. And he's quick to note that while man can see some of the details God works together in the differing seasons of life, he cannot see all those details. And he most certainly cannot see that finished, perfect needlepoint that God is piecing together. And what's implied here is that we cannot trust ourselves to rightly assess the seasons we live through. We can't. But we can know that God knows the beginning from the end, and therefore can and should be trusted wholeheartedly. What are we to do with this revelation? Look at verse 12. "I know that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Look at this. The very best the man with the under the sun perspective can do is try to enjoy himself in this search for good. For the true follower of God, however, we can and we should trust God. He's taking us to heaven. That's eternity. Yes, life in a fallen world is often difficult and painful, but our loving Heavenly Father is kind and merciful and will never test us beyond what He can bear. And so rightly understanding the role and the love of our sovereign God, life can actually be enjoyed even in the toughest times, knowing that eternity will be perfect. If this is the case, then life can be seen as a gift from God. Look at verse 13. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. What does it say? It is the gift of God. Now, can you see the massive difference between the under-the-sun perspective and the above-the-sun perspective? I'm a sojourner. I'm an alien. I'm a visitor. This is not my home. Verse 13, it's a gift of God. What's he saying? When man accepts everything in life, the good, the bad, and the ugly, as a gift of his Creator, even in a cursed world, man is then enabled to find satisfaction in his work. Remember, he said, why waste your time working? It doesn't gain you anything. You can't take it with you. You can find satisfaction in all of your work. Oh, it's not lasting satisfaction. Don't miss that. It's not lasting satisfaction. God never designed His good gifts to be lasting. Lasting satisfaction can only be found in God alone. And so, when pursued in moderation, when not turned into an idol to pursue for life, God can and does send joy to a person's heart even in the midst of the most difficult lives. Take a person like Johnny Erickson Tada. You probably know that name. Teenage girl having fun with her buddies. Dives off a raft in the middle of the lake. Strikes her head on the bottom. And instantly becomes a quadriplegic. Well, if you knew her at all, if you've read any of her books, if you've heard any of her testimonies, the girl can't help but sing. From a human perspective, from an under-the-sun perspective, she has it as bad as a human being could have it. You're saved, die, go to heaven. She longs for heaven, but she longs to stay as healthy as she can because she impacts all those people with an under-the-sun perspective. How's that work? Only God can do that. Only God can do that. Well, Solomon now concludes this section regarding the proper perspective on time as God has ordained. And based on what this most wise man has learned, the seasons of life, the easy ones, the difficult ones, are designed by God to teach men to revere and stand in awe of God. Can you see that that's the exact polar opposite of what the man with the under the sun perspective thinks? Verse 14. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There's nothing to add to it, and there's nothing to take from it, for God has so worked that men should fear Him. What's the beginning of biblical wisdom? The fear of God. Men cannot alter the circumstances through which he passes in this lifetime. Whatever has already been and what will be has been before. He's already said that back in chapter 1, verse 9. And that's just another way to say that God is sovereign. God's in control. The laws of God do not change. He's unchangeable. The world is created in accordance with natural and moral laws. He has set those in place. Those continue in their appointed times. But his design for life is such that man is encouraged to look beyond himself to the higher power behind the order of life and see that it can only be a sovereign God who has ordained all that takes place in life. And remember, it is only and always for the ultimate glory and honor of that sovereign God. Verse 15, that which has been already, and that which will be has already been, for God seeks what has passed by. Now look at this. What Solomon is saying to conclude this section is that God alone is the one to hold man accountable. Therefore, at any time in the future, God can reach back into the past and bring forth what is necessary for the future, for the ongoing development of his plan, or to confront man in judgment for deeds long forgotten in the past. In other words, from God's point of view, he is the only one who can establish the link between the past and the future. Now, what are we to conclude as we come to the end of this section? The man with the above-the-sun perspective recognizes and understands the hand of God at work in every detail of life. The man with the under-the-sun perspective cannot see God at work. And the reason he cannot see God at work is because, catch this, he has suppressed, he has pushed down the evidence of a sovereign God in the world and in his life. And as the Apostle Paul goes on to say, Romans 1, verse 20, that man will be without excuse when he stands before Jesus Christ, the judge of the living and the dead. The question then, as we conclude this section, is how then should we view the seasons of life that we walk through? We forget the good ones, don't we? We focus on the tough ones. The answer is to know that God's hand is at work on the side of the needle point that you can't yet see. Oh, it looks like a mess to you. But you don't see the right side. What you can know is that in the good times and the hard times, God is knitting together a beautiful picture for your life. And the issue is not, can you see it? The issue is, can you trust Him? The more you can remember that, the more you can praise Him and glorify Him in the everyday minutes of life. So what have we learned? We've learned that true enjoyment in all things in this life depends on a higher source than man. Secondly, God is the absolute ruler over his people. And then, catch this, in this next section to the end of this chapter, Solomon is going to tell us that even the perversion of justice in this life must serve the sovereign purposes of God. What? Well, you've got to come back. We'll talk about that, Lord willing, next time. Father, thank you for what we've looked at this evening. And we confess, Father, for so many of us, the toughest times in this life are merely an inconvenience that we're not patient enough to handle. And yet we know, Father, that we have brothers and sisters who are undergoing unimaginable grief and pain. They're being treated as poorly as a person can be treated in this life. And we're tempted to say, just throw it all in and be done with it. But it's only because, as Solomon said, we can't see the end. And so, God, help us to be an encouragement to one another. Help us to be faithful to pray for one another. And help us all to remember that your plan is perfect. You didn't call us to approve it. You called us to trust you. And that's what we desire to do. All this, Lord, we pray in your name. Amen.